Welcome along. This is Mark Stein with another of our Clubland Q&As live around the planet. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, where we were on the inaugural Mark Stein cruise just a few days ago, earlier this month. It's 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland. It's 6 p.m. in Bermuda. It's 9 p.m. in London, 10 p.m. in Paris, 11 p.m. Cairo. I often mention the half-hour time zones. It's 1:30 a.m. in Delhi. But James wants a shout-out for the Nepalese, who are in one of the world's rare quarter-hour time zones. 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time is 1:45 a.m. in Kathmandu. And we love the Nepalese. I think in Mark Stein Head to Toe, there's Mark Stein from Head to Toe, there's a piece about the ill-starred Nepalese monarchy in there. And Mark Stein from Head to Toe. And we love the Gurkhas, of course. So a big shout out to anybody, whether you're actually in Kathmandu or anywhere else. If you are in the service of the Queen in one of the British Army's Gurkha regiments, a big shout out to you. At the Mark Stein Club, we are anti-Burqa but pro-Gurkha. So happy to take questions. If you have a cookery knife, the Argentines didn't like it when the Gurkhas landed on the Falklands because they don't like those fellas sneaking up behind them in the dark with their cookery knives. But if you are ex-Gurkha or current Gurkha, then shoot me a question. We had no Gurkhas. This is my first Q&A since being back on dry land after the Mark Stein Club cruise. I especially want to thank all those who came along from the US, Canada, England, Ireland, Scotland. We had a token Welshman from Carmarthenshire. We also had people from Australia, we departed from Montreal, and we had Ellen, who lived just across the Jacques Cartier Bridge and actually could have walked to the cruise gangplank and boarded the ship just on the other side of the Jacques Cartier Bridge. And then we had people from Australia. I've had a very strong Australian contingent, Hong Kong, New Zealand. I thank you all, and we will be announcing the second Mark Stein cruise very soon. So it's great to be back on dry land and back immersed in after the cleansing waters of the open seas, to be back in all the murk and sewage of politics. If I sound a little down today, I've had a rough day. My beloved cat TJ, who many of you will know from one of our cat songs on the Feline Groovy album, my beloved cat TJ died today and took us all a bit by surprise. I'm going to say a few words about him at the end. And actually, there's a sort of connection. I can't believe I'm saying this, but there's a connection to all these harassing nuisance lawsuits brought by that bum Carrie Katz and CRTV against me that are still going on, even though the bums keep losing. They still keep bringing these worthless garbage suits. But I don't want to get that mixed. I don't want to get that mixed up with my reminiscence of my beloved cat. So I might do that separately. I was asked. People actually asked me on the cruise about these stupid lawsuits. You know, in case you don't know, CRTV broke my contract, fired me, sued me for $10 million, lost, and lost about as totally as you could, and got a huge judgment against them, and then immediately resued. Originally they sued me for $10 million and lost. And then this bum Katz and CRTV resued me for a combined $20 million. And those suits are going down the toilet, even as we speak. And I said, as people asked me about it on the cruise, I said, I can't even be bothered talking about it. He's such a sort of dweeby little nothing of a guy. I'm bored with him. If it wasn't for the fact that he kept suing me, he'd be out of my life by now. But he sort of seems to crave attention in some weird psychological way. So I don't want to talk about that. We said we'd talk on this session. We'd open it up to some of the bigger issues arising from what I talked about with Tucker last night. And, oh, by the way, before I forget, Dennis Miller. People used to love me when I was on Dennis Miller's radio show, and I always used to love being on that show because it always went in directions you never knew about. Dennis and I are going to be on stage together in Pennsylvania and Western New York. We're going to be in Reading, Pennsylvania, and Rochester, New York, and Syracuse, New York, and then Wilkes-Barre. I think that's how you pronounce it. Pennsylvania, because it's like it's spelt like Barry, Vermont, but it's not said like Barry, Vermont. So that when you're touring, the last thing you want to say is, "Hey, it's a privilege to be back in your wonderful city. I love Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Just love it." So it's not like Barry, Vermont, and I'll be on top of that by the time we appear there. But if you're in those neighborhoods, or if you're in Southern Ontario, if you're Kingston, Ontario, it's not that far from Syracuse. If you're on the QEW, on the good old QEW, North America's first auto route, the Queen Elizabeth Way, everyone thinks it's named for the Queen. In fact, it's named for the Queen Mum, because it was ahead of I-95 or any of those. If you're on there, Hamilton, St. Catharines, Niagara Falls, the Rochester show isn't too far from you, and you can go along to steinonline.com, click on the link and find out about that. But we the two Tucker topics, beginning with this Saudi guy, Jamal Khashoggi, who, appears to have happened in the official explanation, was accidentally questioned to death in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. And that was one of the topics I said we'd take questions on. All three versions of it, the Turkish version, which is full of lurid details that they've not actually released any evidence of, i.e. like a 15-strong team of hitmen flew in and entered the building. He went into the building, never came out. There was a bone sawing specialist that supposedly chopped him up into pieces, and he was taken out of the embassy in small boxes and flown in pieces back to Saudi Arabia. That's the Turkish version, which nobody has, they haven't demonstrated any evidence of that. The Saudi version is this was all an accident. They were just torturing him, and unfortunately he accidentally died during the torture. And then they accidentally chopped him into pieces, and then they accidentally took him out of the embassy, and then they accidentally flew the pieces of him back to Saudi Arabia. It's just it was just like a typing error in the memo, and it all got out of hand. That's the Saudi explanation. Basically, the American explanation is just as much complete twaddle. He wasn't a journalist. He was basically a very well-connected spook. He was the right-hand man for many years to Prince Turki, whom I have had some truck with over the years, and who is possibly, even by the standards of that malignant royal family, one of the most sinister members of that family, Prince Turki Al Faisal. And he knew Osama bin Laden, for example, Mr. Khashoggi, and mourned his death. And so he was basically a well-connected spook for whom a little bit of light journalism was a cover. And the Washington Post was happy to assist him in that regard, which I find interesting. I also find it interesting that he apparently got a green card without ever having lived in America, which is, again, interesting and somewhat unusual. But a well-connected guy, he was the nephew of the biggest Saudi arms dealer of his generation, Adnan Khashoggi, whose wife, for those of you who read the Fleet Street tabloids, the devoted Muslim wife, Saraya Khashoggi, wound up having a child who, after paternity testing, the father was Jonathan Aitken, the British MP. who once dated my old friend Carol Thatcher, Mrs. Thatcher's daughter. It's a very small world. And in fact, this guy, Jamal Khashoggi, before he got chopped up in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, his aunt was the mother of Dodi Fayed. In other words, this guy was a first cousin of Dodi Fayed, who died with the Princess of Wales in that automobile in the Paris underpass on August 31st, 1997. Well, we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about the stunning revelation that Elizabeth Warren is 1,024th Native American. She's taken the test, and she's crowing about it. She's actually 1,023 1,024ths white. But if you're 1,023 1,024ths white, that's no reason that you can't be Harvard Law School's first woman of color. That's the world of identity politics. So we'll talk about that. David Elstrom says, with respect to the Saudi journalists, you've got to love the Saudi government's statement that his death was an accident. So the Saudis just intended to torture him, and his unexpected death is his fault. Plus, sneaking out of the embassy one piece at a time was just his clever means of escape. No wonder satire is virtually impossible anymore. Yeah, that's a good point, David. Have you ever seen that Sacha Baron Cohen film, The Dictator? The dictator in question, he's an Arab dictator, and he's kidnapped by, he's in New York to give a speech at the UN, and he's kidnapped and he's taken somewhere, and they're getting out the torture instruments, and he's mocking them as they're getting out the torture instruments. And he's saying, oh, you're not still using that, are you? The Saudis upgraded to the new model of genital electrode clamps 3 years ago. You're not still using the old one. You can't even get tech support for it. So he's doing this whole scene where he mocks them, and in the course of mocking them, he makes the point that the Saudis are state-of-the-art torturers, and they pride themselves on that. So if you're tortured by the Saudis and they didn't intend to kill you and somehow you accidentally wind up dying, that's your fault. That's on you, because they're supremely good torturers. And when they're clamping the electrodes to your genitals, they know exactly how much juice to shoot to you to keep you alive. So David does have a point when it comes to this Saudi side, as Laura Rosen Cohen does it. Says James Worsthorne says, why does appropriation by misrepresentation seem to be a lefty progressive thing? Can you think of any conservative guilty of this most disgraceful act? No. You can't think of it, but that's because it's not important to conservatives. Conservatives, generally speaking, are relaxed about who they are. When you're on the left is concerned with labels, and the labels are dispositive. Because, as we always come back to this, the classic Leninist, Stalinist, whom thing, first formulated by Lenin, who, whom, in any dispute. Once you know the who and the whom, you know the good designated good guy and the designated bad guy. So, for example, if it's Christian versus gay, the Christian is the bad guy and the gay is the good guy. If it's feminist versus trans, as is happening actually quite a lot now, it's rather interesting because trans is the good guy and feminist is the bad guy. If it's Muslim versus gay, unlike Christian versus gay, then Muslim trumps gay. So it's the who, whom thing. And that's important to the left, the label. And the label is dispositive. So you want to be the most favourable label. So here we have Elizabeth Warren. I've done all the jokes about Elizabeth Warren for years. I said on Rush years ago, Elizabeth Warren is the whitest white since Frosty the Snowman fell in a vat of whiteout. I've done all the jokes. You can't even parody this. She submits a traditional Cherokee recipe to the Pow Wow Chow Five Tribes Native American Cookbook. And it's supposedly a traditional Cherokee recipe, a tomato and crab dish. It turns out to be a specialty of a mid-20th century restaurant across the street from the St. Regis Hotel in the heart of Manhattan that was one of the favorite dishes of Cole Porter and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. And I think I said, because we all know the Cole Porter song, I've got Sue under my skin. So I've done all the gags about this, but it's important to her. And it was important to Harvard Law School to be able to trumpet a woman who's 1,024th white as Harvard Law School's first woman of color. James Miller writes, actually, James Miller is just quoting me. Andrew Lawton says, I think Elizabeth Warren is part Gurkha. She certainly looks Gurkha to me, Andrew. But I would want to see what she's like when she's holding the old cookery knife and sneaking up behind Argentines in the dark on South Georgia, or one of the other parts of the Falkland Islands. Was she actually in a Gurkha regiment during the Falklands War? I don't know, but she could be one part Gurkha. I haven't looked at it actually, but she could be one part Gurkha. Would you rather Elizabeth Warren was a Gurkha, or would you rather put her in a burqa? We'll take your questions on that right now. Babs J says, Mark, I have to pick up my sister up at the airport around the time you go live today, so I'm not going to get to submit my question. So I hope you're enjoying this, like if you're stuck at the airport waiting at the gate or whatever to greet your sister. Twitter dropped my account some while ago, so I started a new one so I could follow my son and daughter. I had no problem doing that much. But then I decided to pull up Fox News in the event I decided to follow Fox. As soon as I did that, I got a message from Twitter telling me that they'd discovered some suspicious activity on my account. I had to re-enter my password at that point and assure them it was not suspicious activity. Can you comment on this? Because it sure came across as suspicious activity on their part toward me. I got the feeling I was being flagged right then and there as someone they needed to monitor and possibly censor. Twitter and Facebook are evil, and so's YouTube, and so's Google, and the world they will build for us will be a totalitarian world. I'll give you a small example of that. And Babs, I think you're right. I think this is one of those things. You link to Fox News, or you've started to follow Fox News or whatever, and that counts as suspicious activity. So if you'd done that with MSNBC or CNN, it wouldn't have mattered. I'll give you an example of this. On Friday, we posted a brand new Mark Steyn show that I did with Anne McElhenney and Phelim McAleer. And we did it on stage during the Mark Steyn Show cruise. And it's three of us sitting on stage talking. And if you've ever heard Phelim and Anne, you'll know they're very raucous and lively and funny. And so they made a couple of jokes about the Irish situation. Phelim rather unfairly accused me of trying to kill him, basically, or my people trying to kill his people. I don't even know what that means. But we kicked that around. We kicked that around for a bit. He talked about how everybody loves you when you're Irish around the world. The Irish are some of the most loved people on the planet. You go around the world, everyone loves the Irish. And then they discovered that this guy is a weird, freakish anomaly. He's an Irish conservative, and suddenly you're not the beloved Irish figure anymore. Talked about that. And then Anne talked about how they ought to make right-wing nut job an identity group, and then it would become protected. If you'd say, oh, well, I wasn't born a right-wing nut job, but I'm transitioning into one, so it's my preferred identity, then they would have to recognize it on college. It's a jocular, lively, acerbic, trenchant conversation. Three people on stage But somebody, some little twerpy twerp person at, I don't know whether this was Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or whoever, oh, YouTube, I think, did it, had marked it as sensitive content. So when it's retweeted, it doesn't show, the link doesn't show anything. It just says, oh, this is sensitive content. It's sensitive content because at some point in this conversation that shows three people talking on stage, they mention the abortion referendum in Ireland and talk about the result of it. And so sensitive content means basically embarrassing to Democrats and progressives. And that's how Twitter, and that's how YouTube, and that's how Facebook run their operations. And God rot them. God rot them. They need to be broken up. These are organizations, eventually a cartel of three or four groups will control access to all human knowledge. They're bigger already than Standard Oil was 110 years ago. They should be broken up. They should be broken up. Andy writes, who do you think has more native ancestry, you, Dennis Miller, or Elizabeth Warren? Everybody has more Native American ancestry than Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren having one being 1,024th Native American, that's less than the American average. There are undocumented immigrants who arrived in the country 2 days ago, who are more Native American than Elizabeth Warren. That's less than the average. That's less to be 1,024th Native American is less than the average. So if that's the criterion for being one of the five tribes, then half the country are in the five tribes. Half the country are people of color. Half the country could be hired by Harvard Law School as their first woman of color, if that's the criterion. As for me, I have ancestry from Odessa on the Black Sea. And if I recall my Native American history, the Injuns, as we used to say, they came over the Bering Straits when it was all connected at land before the global warming split Alaska from Siberia, and they came across the Bering Straits and settled North America. And my bet would be that I'm actually far more Native American than Elizabeth Warren because I was already on that side of the Bering Straits. Putin, for example, is probably more Native American than Elizabeth. I would say it's a 1,024ths of the human race is more Native American than Elizabeth Warren. And Michael Covino writes, Mark, Elizabeth Warren releasing her DNA test results is just the latest example of a politician playing under the rules of the game set by President Trump. It reminds me of Marco Rubio responding to Trump's taunts of little Marco with the comment about the size of Trump's hands during the 2016 primary campaign. I must confess, I find Trump's ability to set the narrative of an issue fascinating. It reminds me of the great line that golfer Bobby Jones said of Jack Nicklaus. He plays a game with which I am not familiar. Care to speculate as to why politicians are so willing to undertake such silly actions to take on Trump? There is no way they will win a mud fight with Trump. And why is Trump unwilling to adopt the more appropriate moniker of Pocahontas, given the BS she spews about her ancestry and handed down recipes, says Michael Covino. You make a good point. The Marco Rubio thing was fascinating because Trump started calling Rubio Little Marco. You know, it's fantastic, actually. The way he can bait them and they rise to the bait. The first one was Jeb. You remember he kept calling him low energy Jeb, which was brilliant, actually brilliant. It's like just an adjectival summation, low energy Jeb. He was presumed to be the shoo-in, and yet he couldn't articulate a reason why he was running for president. Low energy Jeb. And at a certain point, Trump baited him into responding. And he stood there on stage, Jeb. He was all petulant and whiny, and he was sort of going, okay, I'm not ashamed to be George W. Bush's brother, okay? I'm not ashamed to be Barbara Bush's son, okay? And Trump just leaned into the microphone and goes, she's the one who should be running. And of course, that's perfectly true. And so basically, Jeb made the mistake of responding and stepped on his own landmine. Same with Little Marco. Little Marco, Little Marco. So Marco Rubio decides to hit back and go, you know, Trump has very small hands, and you know what that means, which led to Trump saying, believe me, because apparently small hands are indicative of other undersized anatomy. And Trump said that, believe me, there's no problem in that department. And it was a very interesting example of how you can't win against Trump by playing on to Trump's rules. Because, as the stand-up comics say, Trump can work blue. So Trump can talk about, believe me, there's no problem in that department. But nobody wants Marco Rubio working blue. There's no market for that. He is Little Marco in that sense. He's supposed to be the squeaky, clean, picture-perfect little dream boy, and nobody wants him suddenly going all potty-mouthed and talking about the size of rival candidates' private parts. It's a good example of how that doesn't work for anyone. Kate Smythe. I want to thank Kate, by the way. Kate came on the Mark Steyn Club Cruise. Bill Leake was a great Australian cartoonist. When I was down there last time, I saw Bill. Bill came to an event of mine, and at the book signing thing afterwards, he stood in line for like an hour and a half or something to get his book signed. And I saw Bill. I looked up from the table. You're just sort of signing, and you look up, see who's next. I looked up and saw Bill and said, oh, why didn't you, you know, we could have... you could have claimed your like VIP privilege, done the John Kerry "Don't You Know Who I Am" routine, and just kind of snuck in right at the front, and I'd have signed yours, Bill, and you could have been out of it. And he said, "That's not how we do things in Australia." And I love that line because it's a very Australian line. Bill is one of the finest of all Australian cartoonists, but unfortunately, that's. Whether that is how they do things in Australia is an open question now, because at the end of his life, he was tormented by Australia's hideous Human Rights Commission. This is a guy who had to move house because jihadist nutcases are trying to kill him. The jihadists and the Australian Human Rights Commission chastising him for hate crimes over an Aboriginal cartoon are actually different points on the same spectrum. They both want to ruin his life and restrain his freedom of expression. And so he had to move house because the jihadists wanted to kill him. And I believe the legal torment he was put through by the Australian Human Rights Commission, a disgusting organization, absolutely disgusting, is part of what caused his fatal heart attack. A day after a book launch with Barry Humphries in his Sir Les Patterson persona. And Kate very kindly on the cruise gave me some Bill Leake cartoons that Bill's son had given Kate. And Kate had given to me. I'm very touched by that, Kate. And I was very glad to see you and a splendidly enthusiastic Aussie contingent on the cruise. Kate says, "I would appreciate hearing your thoughts on the renewed push by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation at a recent UN General Assembly to prevent defamation of Islam and make it illegal and punishable by law. The OIC adopted a statement jointly proposed by Turkey and Pakistan. Meanwhile, hashtag Hang Asia, the Pakistani Christian woman Asia Bibi facing execution for blasphemy, is trending on social media, and judges involved in the appeal are receiving death threats. And two, Kate says, if Rachel Dolezal was guilty of not only cultural appropriation but fraud in obtaining employment based on racial affirmative action, then how can Elizabeth Warren get away with it, including career advancement via Harvard Law? Did Dolezal ever undergo DNA testing to demonstrate even one 128th African-American heritage? Well, on that last point, Kate, this is the insanity of it. This is the one drop rule which they used to have in the American South, where you could have of your great grandparents, seven of the eight could be white, but if one was black, then under the South's old Democrat enforced one drop rule, you were a Negro in the racial classification of Democrats in the American South. Now science is on their side, so they can actually pinpoint it. So it's like literally one drop in the case of Elizabeth Warren. And again, it gets to this whole, it does get to this whole cultural appropriation thing. If it's cultural appropriation, and you'll know that Lionel Shriver, a guest on the Mark Steyn Show, got into trouble for wearing a sombrero in Australia because she was appropriating Hispanic heritage, Mexican heritage, whatever the hell it was. But apparently actually pretending, you know, what Elizabeth Warren did was literally appropriate the job of an authentic Indian. I'm not going to say Native American is a mumbo-jumbo term. Let's say Indian, because she's about as authentically Native American as a cigar store Indian. If you took a cigar store Indian and analyzed the wood used to make it, you'd find that was 1,024th Cherokee. So you've got a real cultural appropriation in small ways and big. For example, powwow chow. Now, suppose you take seriously the idea of a Five Tribes cookbook. As I said on Tucker, the House of Windsor is not one of the Five Tribes, as far as I know. I'm not an expert in this area, but I believe the House of Windsor is not one of the Five Tribes. So when you have the Duke and Duchess of Windsor's favourite crab and tomato, actually, we might as well say crab and tomato, because that's how the Duke would have said it. The favourite crab and tomato recipe of the Duke of Windsor, that's actually taking the place of an authentic Cherokee recipe in that Five Tribes cookbook. So cultural appropriation comes at a price. The Duke of Windsor's favourite crab and tomato dish has taken the place of an authentic Cherokee recipe. Just as assuming Harvard Law School is genuine in that it was looking for a woman of colour, a first woman of colour, by pretending to be Cherokee, Elizabeth Warren took the place of an authentic Indian applicant to Harvard Law School. So that's actual real cultural appropriation. I mean, the left is essentially frivolous because it's all about control. So, for example, if you wear a sombrero on Cinco de Mayo and you're Nigel Fortescue Smith, or Smythe, like Kate Smythe, then you're not doing anything that makes any difference to anyone, but they beat you to a pulp because the point is to control you. It doesn't matter to anything. It doesn't matter at all. But on the other hand, if you actually are taking the place of real, if you're appropriating fake identities to advance yourself in jobs, affirmative action type jobs, so you're purporting to be a woman of colour when you're the whitest white since Frosty the Snowman fell in a vat of whiteout, that doesn't matter to them because they've succeeded in imposing their rules on you. So if they've got people so nutso that they're perfectly white and they're pretending to be people of colour, like we see with Elizabeth Warren and like we see with those goons on the streets of Portland, Oregon, a couple of weekends ago, where they're sneering at drivers and threatening them for being a little whitey-whitey person, when they're perfectly white themselves but don't seem aware of it, the left doesn't mind because they've succeeded in imposing those rules on those people. Read the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Last time I checked, I think there were 58, 59 countries in the OIC. It may even be more now. So basically, that's a third of the members of the UN, right? This is the way to think about it. The General Assembly will at some point make defamation, so-called defamation of Islam, illegal and punishable by law, because when you've already got a third of the members of the UN in the OIC, you don't need many others to tip it over to 51% of the membership. And then you have to bear in mind the words of Barack Obama at the UN General Assembly just a couple of years ago when he said the future will not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam. Screw off out of here, man. You can't slander the dead. You can say what you like about some bloke who's been pushing up daisies for 1,300 years. You ain't gonna... That guy is not defamable, and it is no business of the citizen representative who heads the United States of America to say that it is. They're serious about this stuff, and too many craven nothings on our side are willing to cave into it. Laura Rosen-Cohen says, will the civilized world ever tell the Saudis to go to hell? We need to tell people to go to hell on a lot of this stuff. Yes, the fact that you... happen to be a practicing Muslim, a believing Muslim, is fine and dandy, but I'm not. So if you say that that your strictures apply to me, you're basically conscripting me in your religion. If you don't want to draw Muhammad, that's fine. But I'm not a Muslim, so drawing Muhammad is fine for non-Muslims. Uncovered women is fine for non-Muslims. The minute you accept this, basically you're doing what too many people in the Western world do, and saying the strictures of Islam apply to all. Andrew A. writes, will all the prince's horses and all the prince's men ever put Khashoggi together again? Donald J. Trump has just said he spoke with the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who totally denied any knowledge of what took place in their Turkish consulate. He said during the call that he has already started and will rapidly expand a full and complete investigation into this matter. I understand that that according to President Trump, he said that the FBI are willing to give the Saudis a hand. They found it in a bathroom at the airport in Istanbul, and they just want to check. They don't know if it belongs to this guy. This is who the Saudis. Every Prince Turki wasn't so good at it because he was a kind of obviously sinister guy. But the guys who run Saudi Arabia are very good at coming over as charming and urbane and amusing company when they're in the West. The guy who preceded Prince Turki as Saudi ambassador in Washington, Prince Bandar, a particularly oleaginous fellow, was extremely good at this. He was Saudi ambassador in Washington for over 20 years, well-connected with all the Bushes and all the rest of those guys. There's that awful picture. I think he's at Bush's ranch in Texas, or Bush is at his ranch in Montana, whatever. But he's sort of sitting behind Bush, and he's got his sort of foot up on the armrest of the chair or something. So he appears very much to be dominating Bush. And it's one of those pictures that unintentionally sums up the relationship. Saudi Arabia is a malign creation. And this tension, basically, Khashoggi was a Muslim Brotherhood propagandist. So the Saudis believe in strict Wahhabist theocracy. Khashoggi, who was an insider who fell out with the House of Saud and then began representing himself as an outsider, he basically believes in Egyptian-style Muslim Brotherhood democracy, as happened after Mubarak. You elect the Muslim Brotherhood. You believe in democracy, so it can elect a Muslim Brotherhood government that will then impose its Islamic theocracy on the nation. So that's basically, you know, either way, there's no good guy in that fight. There's no good guy in that fight. And then you have his ally, his friend, who's the big advisor to Erdogan in Turkey. There's tension between the new caliph, the would-be Ottoman caliph, Erdogan, in Istanbul, and the powers that emerged after the fall of the last Ottoman Empire, such as the Saudis. And so there's a whole, it's basically an intra-theocratic Islamic dispute. Where's the next one? Oh, yeah, here we are. Mark. Oh, I tell you what, before I forget, because I don't want this to get mixed up when I remember my cat. I was on a plane the other day and I had to look. I can't remember which of these stupid suits, these stupid, pathetic suits that cats and CRTV have put me through. But I was asked about this on the cruise. So I want to say a word about this. On one of these suits, the judge said to CRTV, this statement of claim, whatever you call it in America, the complaint, half of it's rubbish. You need to update it. And so they threw in some remarks I made on the first anniversary of the Mark Steyn Club, in which I spoke about one of the most bizarre elements of the dispute with CRTV, which is the fact that their security guard, I discovered one night, their security guard in the act of stealing my cat's cat tree, the cat who died this morning. Who does that? I mean, I've had a hell of a life. I've been in all kinds of places. I've been in the Sunni Triangle in Iraq. I've been in Mostar in Bosnia, where the Muslims and Christians fell out and blew up the bridge. I've never had to worry in any of those situations. I've felt a bit worried about this or a bit worried about that. Those guys, crazy as they were, didn't steal other people's cat trees. That insanity didn't come into my life until the lunatic cats did. And Carrie Katz did, and he had his security guard. His security guard stole my cat tree, and we caught him in the act of stealing the cat tree. And because he happened to be an ex-policeman, and it doesn't look good when ex-law enforcement engages in theft, we called him as he was fleeing with his ill-gotten gains back to southern Vermont and suggested he might like to turn around and return the cat tree. And this was my cat who died this morning. This was my cat's custom-built cat tree by a company in southern Ontario because it was a very corpulent cat. So we had this cat on the set, and you can still see it on some of the stuff we do, although we might retire it because I associate it with him now. So we got it back. So I truthfully mentioned that CRTV's security guard had stolen my cat tree. And so a couple of weeks ago in one of these total pointless, stupid, going nowhere suits that these loonies keep filing, they say, oh, it's disparagement and defamation to say CRTV guy stole his cat tree. No, it isn't. It's true. But I'm sitting on a plane dealing with this rubbish from CRTV, new complaint saying that it's defamatory of them to say they stole my cat tree. My cat is dead, and the complaint about the cat tree will outlive my cat by, what, 2-3 years? This is the sickness of the American so-called justice system. Absolute sickness. It's nonsense. And I actually feel dirty just being in the system. But I don't know why anybody else doesn't feel dirty. I mean, they're third-rate lawyers saying, what do we got on Steyn? Oh, well, he said we stole his cat tree. Well, we did steal his cat tree. I know that, but we'll still put it in there anyway. It's There's a nice young lady lawyer working on it who she used to be a sort of actress. She was in crappy movies like Wild Things 2, and I guess she wanted to do something else with her life. I tell you something, I'd rather be in Wild Things 47 than suing a guy for daring to mention that that her client stole his cat tree. Anyway, that's the connection. Believe me, this cat tree thing will be, they won't get anywhere with that. But I wanted to get that out of the way now, because I don't want to mention it when I do my reminiscence about my beloved cat. So let us see. The King of Saudi Arabia, says Walt Trimmer, is the protector of Mecca and Medina and responsible for the Hajj. Now they have vast wealth and a substantial number of the royal family have been playboys in the Western world. The kings have been bribing the Wahhabi clerics to maintain their religious authority and doing their best to distribute the wealth to avoid revolution. There is a substantial Shia minority in the eastern part of the kingdom that would align with Iran. Lately, King Salman, and especially his son Mohammed, have been busy suppressing the Wahhabis. The kingdom is a powder keg for these and several other reasons. Being foreign infidels, how can our involvement in this issue help anything? Well, we are involved because they would be still bloody useless Bedouin in their awful camps with great mounds of garbage on the edge of camp if it weren't for Westerners. They're not capable of getting the oil out of the ground themselves. That's why everybody who does anything of any consequence in Saudi Arabia is a foreign worker. Now, they're total hypocrites. Every year, the king and the big shop princes, everyone's a prince in Saudi Arabia. I used to tease my late friend Ghazi al-Ghasaibi, the Saudi minister of labor and minister of sewage, because he was the only Saudi I'd ever met who wasn't a prince. Everyone is a prince. They don't restrict it. In the royal family, for example, you have to be the Queen and the Prince of Wales and the Duke of Sussex and all that gang. You have to be direct male line grandson of the sovereign to be a prince. But in the Saudi royal family, princes breed princes, breed princes, breed princes. So there's over 10,000 princes. And every year the big shop princes go to a Spanish resort. And there's an escort agency in London, in Mayfair, who have the exclusive contract to supply all the escorts for the Saudi princes. And they all have to be blondes. And the girls are rotated in and out of there every 2 weeks, because at the end of the 2 weeks, they're absolutely worn out. They're exhausted. They're no good for anything. So they have to fly in new girls. The whole Saudi state is premised upon hypocrisy. And that's extremely difficult to sustain. And I don't know whether you can so-called... everyone says, this new King Salman and his son, they're such liberalizers. They're letting women drive automobiles. That's fantastic. Who would have thought of such... No, who thinks of not letting women drive automobiles? No other country. Not since the automobile was invented. When the automobile... Henry Ford started the Model T, he didn't say, well, this is great for guys, but the women, they're still going to be on the buses and trolley cars. Only Saudi Arabia thinks like this. And as I said on Tucker last night, it's basically ISIS with diplomatic recognition. Matthew McWilliam says, Mark, it seems that the pushback against Antifa is beginning. In the past couple of days, I've noticed stories about confrontations in Portland and New York between Antifa and a right-wing group apparently called the Proud Boys. Most notable to me about the New York incident is that the NYPD seem to have identified at least 9 fellows from the Proud Boys to charge with assault and riot, but seemed to be short of folks on the other side to charge. Even though Antifa seemed to have sought out the conflict and several of the participants from Antifa were left sprawled on the ground when the police arrived. The New York authorities seem more interested in whether or not the Antifa victims want to press charges. Any thoughts on this? Absolutely. We actually saw this in Charlottesville, where seeing the concert, and we've seen it in university towns, we're seeing the consequences of politically correct policing. I'm not a believer in descending to the same level as Antifa and all the rest of it, but that it happens is not surprising. What is disturbing is that the one-sided policing that is going on of these things, because they know. Actually, you saw that with a lot of people who trashed the town during the Trump inauguration last year. Same thing. We have politically correct policing in many of these cities, and that isn't going to go well. Walter Danow says, thoughts on Cambridge University Student Union voting against commemorating Remembrance Day. They said it, quote, glorifies war and amounts to jingoistic imperialist propaganda. One of the most moving sites, actually, I was just off the Mark Steyn cruise. I've taken cruises at odd times where in the run-up to Remembrance Day, Armistice Day, Veterans Day in the United States, run-up to November 11th, I found myself coming into some obscure corner of the British Commonwealth. Doesn't matter whether it's Bermuda or Grand Turk. It's always very moving to me. To go into town, see people wearing their poppies in their lapels and preparing to honour the dead, not just from the Great War, the First World War, 100 years ago, but from all the wars since. It's become the symbol of sacrifice in war in Commonwealth countries. It honours the fallen. It honours the dead. It doesn't do more than that. It doesn't make any claims for the war aims of the particular conflict or the strategic genius of the staff officers and the generals and field marshals who ran it. It simply honors the dead. And as I'll be saying in a upcoming a poem for our Sunday poem series. It was a spontaneous, literally organic symbol of the dead in war, because when the ground becomes soaked in human blood and human flesh, and it becomes a great burial ground for humanity in large numbers, poppies bloom. In France and Belgium. That's where the imagery comes from. It goes back a couple of hundred years. If you've read Macaulay, the great English historian, you'll know that he remarks on it there. That's all it does. It's the 100th anniversary of the war to end old war, all wars. And it didn't end all wars. It was a spontaneous reaction to the death of one's comrades in battle. It wasn't chosen in that sense by politicians or anything like that. It became an image of sacrifice in war because of one man, a Canadian doctor, a Canadian surgeon, soldier, and sometime poet, John McCrae, who noticed when he buried his friend the plethora of poppies. And there's something so stupid about a moronic present tense culture that cannot understand that death in battle and the idea of soldiering as an obligation of citizenship, as part of what it means to belong to any country, any society, any tribe in parts of the world, was part of humanity until very, very recently. It's not about jingoist imperialist propaganda. It's about honouring the deaths of all men in battle and acknowledging their sacrifice. Simply saying, as the, in the words of the poem, at the going down of the sun, we shall remember them. And the, there were know-nothings at Cambridge think, eh, it's a bummer to remember them. We'd rather just write the whole thing off as crappy imperialist propaganda. It's a shameful decision, actually, that. And they should be ashamed of it. And it's terrible, that. Wear a poppy. You know, I can't get over that. I've been all over the world, in all different parts of the Commonwealth in the run-up to November 11th. And I always stop. It doesn't matter if I'm... They don't sell them in, obviously, in the United States. It's not a symbol here. But if I'm in Montreal in the run-up and I see a guy from the Royal Canadian Legion in the street, I buy a poppy. You should buy a poppy. We live in the world. We still basically live in the world created by the Second World War. We live in the peace established by 1945, and it's now seven decades of that peace, so that we have 20-year-olds who know nothing, who don't understand how rare a moment in human history this is. To be able to grow up without the idea of seeing your cities leveled, reduced to rubble, burned to the ground, that is actually a very rare moment in human history. And to be unable to actually honour the sacrifice of your, okay, maybe because you're 20 years old, maybe your dad knows nothing about it too. Maybe your grandfather knows nothing about it, but your great-grandfather certainly did, and your great-great-grandfather. And if being 1,024th Native American is enough to make Elizabeth Warren Cherokee, then being the great-great-grandchild of someone who went off and fought on the Western Front between 1914 and 1918, you should be able to find sufficient kinship with him to remember him and honour him and wear a poppy. And to hell with you if you can't. Thank you for all your questions. We've had a ton of questions, so we're going to do one of our, which we occasionally do, one of our follow-up Mark's mailboxes in a couple of days, and I'll attend to some of these questions in video format. But I wanted to say a word about my cat, TJ. This came up when I made my cat album. And the first video I made from the cat album was my version of I Tore a Putty Tat in the style of Sting's Every Breath You Take. So we did that as an 80s rock video. And as I said, my cat album is about Marvin, who was inspired by Marvin, who was a small black cat, a rather attractive black cat. But I wanted to do a video of She Always Talks That Way to the Cat, which was a very obscure Ray Stevens song. You know Ray Stevens, he did The Streak and he did that sort of country music version of Misty. And he's like a funny guy, Ray Stevens. And he had this one song that he'd done that I didn't really feel he'd got the full juice out of. And it was like a cute song, and I wanted to do it, and he'd done it in a sort of rather throwaway version, but I wanted to do that song. And so we wanted to make a video of the song, and Buddy Kalb wrote it. He wrote it as a country song, and we did it. And Marvin wasn't that good. He didn't look right for it. He was too cute. It's about a big, fat, lazy cat. Lazy yellow cat. So we needed a big, fat, lazy cat. And there's never one to hand when you need one. And people were like pimping their cats to me to try and get them into the video because they thought it would be a big opportunity. Might lead to a commercial for Purina, might lead to a spot in the next Bond movie with the Blofeld bringing back and stroking the cat. They always are all so people pimping out their cats. And we couldn't find the cat. I'm a perfectionist, and so I wanted a cat who looked just right. And we got word that at a pet shelter in Newport, Vermont, they had this cat. And we went there, and saw this big old fat cat, who actually appeared to be even older because the cat had come from Quebec. And in Quebec, they do the date, they do it year, month, day. And so the cat appeared because I think the year had been 02 or something, or whatever it was. The cat was made to appear actually years older than the cat actually was. And so nobody wanted this cat. And then he'd been declawed. His previous owners had declawed him, so he couldn't go outside, so nobody wanted him. And then he'd got like to 10 years old, and they got a cute little kitten, and they said, to hell with this cat, we want him out. So they couldn't find anyone who wanted him in Magog, Quebec, so he wound up, I think he's as undocumented as me, he wound up actually coming into Newport, Vermont, and there. And we went, I said, this cat looks just right for the video. This cat is great, just right for the video. And so we put him in the car, and it's Newport, Vermont. So the first thing that happens is we drive onto Main Street, and they've got the railway crossing thing is down, and the traffic's backed up. And so we sit there for like 20 minutes, and then eventually they figure out the railway crossing barriers are broken. They've fallen down and stuck, and they can't get up because, like, nothing works. So eventually some constable comes out, and he's trying to lift up the railway crossing and hold it up so the cars can get through, because nothing works. Nothing works. And meanwhile, by that time, the cat's like fed up with being in the carrier. So I let the cat out, and this big old fat lazy cat is all over the car as we're trying to nudge under the policeman holding up the crossing and everything. We get him home. We do the video with him. I was planning, of course, and just doing the video, tying a brick around him and then tossing him down a well, because we only needed the cat for the video. But he was so great in the video that I decided I couldn't live without him. He was a great companion. My son my youngest kid used to think he was like the coolest cat in the world, because he never did. He was like a big, huge, fat cat, and he just used to lie on his back in a certain point of the living room with his legs in the air. He'd lie like that for like 6 hours, and then he'd think, it's a bit boring just lying here on my back for 6 hours. So he'd get up, and then he'd go like 3 feet away and lie on his back over there for another 5 hours. He was a terrific cat. He had no claws, but he had terrific attitude. So he could take down mice. Even though he had no claws, because he'd been declawed by these previous owners, he could take down mice. He was the alpha male in my house, because I'm like just a wimpo Canadian show tune queen, and the other two male cats are like sort of, and he was like the dog is just like kicked around by this clawed, declawed cat. And so the cat actually taught me a lot about how much you can get by on swagger and attitude. Anyway, here's the song. You can find this on the internet. Buddy Kalb's song. It's basically a one joke song, and you get the idea of it pretty quickly. But if you go and you see the accompanying video of this. And the reason I was going to do, there's like, however, 12 tracks on the album. We're going to do videos for them with all cats. And so I would have wound up with 12 cats. But then that bastard sued me for $10 million. And so the money I would have spent on the other cat videos all went to lawyers. But we did do this one, and I'm delighted. And it stars my late friend TJ, who died this morning. If you look at the video on the internet. Words and music by Buddy Kalb. This is me and the ladies doing She Only Talks That Way to the Cat. I was snoozing on the sofa when she came in from work. She started baby talking, and she sure didn't shirk. How's mama's pookie wookie? How's a big sweetie pie? I kinda smiled and I opened one eye. Yeah, mama's gone get lovey-doveys, had a hot day. I was just about to answer her when I heard her say, you so fat and lazy, but you're sweet as can be. That's when I knew she wasn't looking at me.
oh, oh, I wish she'd talk to me like that. Didn't care where I scratched or sat, and gave me praise for being lazy and fat. But she only talks that way to the cat. Oh yeah, she only talks that way to the cat. And would you look at him? He's just an ugly big ball of fur. It's not as if he even cares a thing about her. He doesn't work, he's never even caught a small mouse, but she treats him like he's king of the house. Sure, I'm a little overweight, I treat her like I don't care. I got laid off of work, I ain't going nowhere. Still, it's a mystery to me, I simply can't understand. Or what she loves in that cat, she can't stand in a man. Oh, I wish she'd talk to me like that. Didn't care where I scratched her sand, and gave me praise for being lazy and fat. But she only talks that way to the cat. Oh yeah, she only talks that way to the cat.
You wish she talked to you like that.
I do.
Didn't care where you scratched or sat.
Why not?
Gave you praise for being lazy and fat.
Yeah, right, she only talks that way to the cat.
Oh yeah,
she only talks that way to that big old cat.
Yeah, a song from me to you with Janet, Mary and Emma on backing vocals. She only talks that way to the cat in memory of my beloved cat who came into my life purely for the purposes of the accompanying video and a great worn out, declawed, fat old cat that nobody else wanted, that they couldn't give away at that shelter. And that cat came into my life for 2.5 years, and neither he nor I knew it would be among the worst 2.5 years of my life. But that cat was there for me every day, and TJ died this morning, and I miss him enormously, and he leaves a huge hole. So thank you to him, and do look him up in the accompanying video. Thank you for all your questions. The ones we didn't get to, we will attend to in a video edition of Mark's Mailbox in a couple of days. We'll have some more audio entertainment for you at the end of the week. I'll be back with John Oakley on AM 640 in Toronto tomorrow afternoon. That's Wednesday afternoon at 5 p.m. Eastern Time in Toronto. I haven't been with John for a while. Hope you'll join me for that. I'm going to be in Massachusetts, I think towards the end of the month, October 28th. You can see that on the Stein Live page on the website. And don't forget those Dennis Miller shows in Pennsylvania and Western New York. And upcoming news about our cruise. Thank you so much for joining us. It is just after 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. I think in southern and eastern Australia, they've already gone on to summertime over there. So wherever it is where you are, I hope you have enjoy the rest of the day. And I'll see you on the radio with John Oakley tomorrow.